what's the Hollywood for recourse, and what does recourse mean?
Okay, what is the Pali word for recourse, and what does recourse mean? Let's see. Okay, the word is patisarana. Patisarana, which means protection or shelter or refuge, also means recourse, reliance, support, dependence on. Can also mean as protection, as a shelter, as a refuge. So maybe we could say dependence? No. Reliance. Yeah, I don't know. It's an awkward word, I agree.
I think it's the same as the Buddha Sarana Pachami, the Sarana.
Okay, yeah, Sarana, yeah, yeah. Protection, shelter.
The site, the first part of the sutta when it describes the site, the sound, could you repeat that for me, please?
Okay, Master Gotama, these five faculties have different domains, different resorts. They do not experience each other's resort and domain. What five? The eye faculty, the ear faculty, the nose faculty, the tongue faculty, the body faculty. Okay? Five faculties with different domains and resorts.
I think that's the same point. It describes the Navabodhi. I don't know what it means, but I think that's what...
Okay, well, the Pali word here is nana visayani, okay, with various environments, with different fields, with different domains. Okay, various environments, different fields, different domains. Well, he might have already had a very well-developed kind of sense of anatta, in that, whenever there's sight, there's just sight, you know. Never mind all these specific things in front of me here. No, it's just all sight. It's just the domain of sight. And it doesn't matter whether there's different sounds or whatever. You know, maybe a cat is meowing over here, and then I hear a bird over there. Oh, it's just sound. It's just the domain of sound. So he's just taking that as a... With anatta, very depersonalized. And if you are going to meditate, I say, yeah, that is the right thing to do. That is to kind of just open up to the senses in that way fully, and then to kind of have a depersonalized experience of it in this very full and raw kind of way. I agree, that is the way to do it. So, this Brahman Unnabha may already have a pretty advanced, meditation in this way, like seeing anatta in these different senses,
It's like Bahya's teaching, except that's...
Bahya also would similarly be able to do this. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, this is almost like another Bahya.
Buddha was teaching Bahya this. Unnabha is already saying it.
Well, yeah, it's kind of, this is a similar sutta to the Bahya sutta, I would say, yeah. Like this Brahman Unnabha. Yeah, it stands to reason, yeah. Yeah, like this Brahman Unnabha probably had a lot of practice and development of his own leading up to this meeting. He's probably a spiritual seeker who's made some progress already. Okay, question?
I'd like to ask about faith must be put in context. participate in context. So it's very interesting you highlight, as for me, as a monk, that you have that kind of discussion that you ask. It's very interesting for me. So I like to put in the context, during the Buddha, like that particular example, in one sitting, this Bhante is not even a Buddhist, become a non-believer. In one sitting, there's 2,600 years ago. So by today, the teaching of Buddha has been casted throughout the world, and perhaps a billion people listening. And when it comes to faith,
well, this story doesn't really reveal this Brahmin Unnava's past practices. Doesn't reveal his past, development. At the time of the Buddha's enlightenment, he kind of wondered who he would share this new knowledge with. His new enlightenment. Who would he share this with? Who would he teach this to? And then he recollected the names of two of his former teachers, and then he wanted to share with them, but then they died. But we know for sure he had past teachers, and we know that, it stands to reason that those teachers did have some knowledge, some talent, Maybe they weren't arahants, but they had something worth learning, which the Buddha learned. The Hindus, you'd be surprised. They have their own meditation techniques and their own teachings. And now, I wouldn't agree with all their teachings, but some of the concepts do overlap. Some of it is pretty similar. When I was in Sri Lanka, at Na Uyana, I met a few Indian monks, like they're citizens of India. And a couple of them used to be Hindu monks. Like they had practiced, studied in Hinduism for several years. Then they disrobed from that and then became Buddhist monks. So they already had experience. This one monk I made friends with, Indian monk, he was saying, the Hindu monks can attain some of the stages of jhana, maybe not all nine of them, but this monk made the claim all the way up to the sixth jhana. He said, when the Hindus are talking about this concept, Atman, it's like the big cosmic self, okay? It's like when they say, oh, we are all one, they're referring to this Atman, this one big cosmic self. We are all one. And when one enters the sixth jhana, it's called the base of infinite consciousness. So one feels as though one's mind is kind of expanding to include the whole universe. It kind of becomes super duper huge, like it goes out into space. Feels like infinity in all directions. And the Hindus are like, there's your Atman. We call that Atman. They're like, there's your one big self. That experience. That is to be one with Atman. So they... this monk friend of mine basically believed the sixth jhana and the teaching of Atman are the same thing. The same thing. Yeah, so this it is conceivable that this Brahmin Unnava has had some, good meditation leading up to this and practice. And yeah. Now the sutta is kind of glossing over this extremely juicy detail, right? I sure would like to know more, but oh well, it's not in there. Yeah, I agree with you. Yeah, Buddhism's being spread everywhere. It's on the internet. Yeah, okay, yeah, you're right. But it is not easy for there to be any like depth of practice though. You know what I mean? So you all came here to spend, you know, I guess it's, from the 12th to the 20th, you're dedicating, you're living here, you know, 24 hours a day. And most people will never do that, actually. Even most Buddhists won't ever do that. Like, go on a 10-day retreat or 9-day retreat. You know, maybe they come to the monastery, they offer some dana, they maybe cook some food for the monks or something. And that's awesome. But when you actually spend time like this, you are gaining depth of practice. You know, you're building up momentum. And so all these, sure, there's lots of, you know, monks in YouTube videos and such, you know, but is there any depth, you know, when, like, somebody can just watch half a Dhamma talk, you know, they watch for, I don't know, 20 minutes, half an hour, and then, like, an advertisement comes on in the middle of the Dhamma talk, there's an advertisement. You know, like now YouTube will like just cut it, you know, just cut right in there and show you an advertisement, which I feel is really not cool. You know, that's the Buddha never had advertisements in the middle of his Dhamma talks ever.
Can you do this advertisement? You have to pay or
make
cancel all this
YouTube subscription.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, you're right. Yeah, they want you to pay to not see the advertisements. But, even if you pay, though, okay, then the next big problem is, like, so YouTube's figured out what sorts of things you like, okay? What topics you're interested in. And, as you know, there's all these recommended videos down the side. So there's all these other suggestions sitting right there. Okay, you're trying to look at this one boring monk in the middle. He's just talking. He's just, you know, there's no flashing colors or, you know, there's no Lamborghinis or anything like this. And, you know, it's just a talking head. And, like, wow, I better keep my Dhamma talk super interesting at all times. I cannot afford to be boring for, like, 2 minutes, okay? Or someone is just going to click some other thing that's interesting. Oh, well, I'm going to look at this... There's a video, you know, a new video game that came out. I'll just click that, you know? And that's it, I'm gone. Now they're looking at this other thing. So, you know, like, you'll notice that here in the monastery. You know, here you are in a room. It does not matter where you point your head. You see Buddhism. You know what I mean? That's on purpose. Your attention is kind of... been captured in here, in this room, you know? That's on purpose. Every look you see Buddha statues, it's all Buddhism.
There's a bit of Hinduism
over there. Well, okay, you're right. There's a bit of Hinduism over there. But you know what I mean? There's not some, you know, dancing lady over here and then an exploding building over here and, you know, like... you know what I mean? I'm not competing with just every other person on this planet who wants attention, okay? There's just oceans of people on YouTube who want your attention. For any reason, not Buddhism, not spirituality, not any reason, you know? I'm sure you all know this, so... it's hard to compete. It's hard to compete with all that, you know. There's, I try to occasionally tell some jokes or something, but that's about all I can do, you know. I can't get too entertaining here. It would be improper, right? Anyway, so yeah, depth of practice is a big deal, I say. And, so we meet characters in the suttas a lot where there is a lot of depth of their practice. And it might not be obvious. The sutta doesn't really say it. But it stands to reason. Like these, you know, these Brahmins, some of them were kind of corrupt and they didn't really practice much, but some, they were, you know, they were sadhus. This was full time for them. You know, they had their own sort of system of practice, and yeah, so they would have some depth of practice for sure. Okay, any last questions?
Okay. Ajahn, about the devotee of faith, I think in the Mahanama Sutta, Tara Nikaya 6, Sutta number 10, there are these six recollections: the Buddha Nusati, Dhamma Nusati, Sangha Nusati, Sila Nusati, Jaga Nusati, and Devata Nusati. So the first five actually coincides with faculty of faith that Ajahn mentioned, right? Where you either fulfill first of these three, or the Sila Nusati, or either Jaga Nusati. Anyway, that's the fact. My point is, the first three faculties, right, that the Buddha gave in that suttas, the Buddha lists out the standard tropes, like you recollect the ETPs or something, all this quality, then the Dhamma qualities and Sangha qualities. So how does one practice those three recollections such that it gives rise to joy instead of merely reciting the words? That sort of chanting kind of does not work for some people like me.
Okay, so you're wondering, how do we find joy in those recollections?
Yes.
Different recollections. Like Buddha Nusati, Dhamma Nusati, Sangha Nusati. Well, I think this is going to be different from person to person. Where I get joy in practice is, if I were to describe it, it would sound so strange to you that you would hardly believe it. But what I was saying earlier about kind of opening up to the senses. I was just saying a bit earlier about, you know, like just see sight as all sight, or hearing as just hearing. You know, it's not like a meowing cat here and a bird there. No, it's just hearing. It's just sound. When I'm able to open up my senses like that, that's very joyous for me. So I'm not recollecting specific things. Buddha Nusati, Dhamma Nusati. It's not specific things. It's more just open up, and then just to the different senses, like sight itself, hearing itself, or even just smell itself, taste itself. For each of these senses, can I have a very direct and raw experience? Yeah, so for me, that's kind of the direction to go in my practice. It's not so much about studying and lists of dhammas and, you know, analysis and all this stuff. Like, my personality already has kind of too much of that. You know, I've got a computer science degree, okay? That's kind of my strength. In fact, it's like I do that too much. I analyze things too much. I'm already strong in that category. So for me, my progress and you know, my joy is, it's in the other direction. It's like, set aside all that analysis and set aside all those concepts. And it's not about studying. It's not about... Well, there's some study. You know, I need to present a competent-sounding Dhamma talk to you, and there's some study there. But... you know, if I want to be joyous, it is not by reading these suttas. It is not by studying. It's not by memorizing. It's like, go outside and just walk and look at the sky. You know, open up, see right out to the side. See right high and right low. Like, see, open up my vision and just feel my entire body, head to toe. Feel the whole thing. And just, like, experience the senses that way, very open senses. Like sixth sense basis, basically. It's like a sixth sense base kind of a meditation. The Buddha does give this this one teaching I really love, where he says, it's in the Kala Karma Sutta, where he says, in the sensed, there's just the sensed. Yeah, in the sensed, there's just the sensed. So whatever I'm sensing, sight or hearing or whatever, there's just that. There's just that. There's no sense of Bhante Subro. There's no sense of other people. There's no sense of any concept at all. It's just the sensory data. And no other thing. Yeah. And then this sets aside all the thinking and analyzing. Yeah. So that works well for me, and I that's the best way for me to feel joy.
Too lofty.
Well, it took quite a while to develop that. Only 9 years into being a monk did this really start working for me. This I'm talking to a monk who ordained like last week. Yes.
Is this a bit similar like Bhante Agachita? He said like you open eyes, meditation, you just see what it is.
Yeah, yeah. I actually learned something interesting recently. There's this optometrist here in Malacca, and he offered me a free, eye exam. And these are got some new glasses, he gave me glasses. And I was explaining how I love to do this meditation where I really open up my vision to the sides, and I can see around the rims of the glasses. I can see above the rims and below. I see the rims in front of my eyes, and I see around them too. Open up my vision. And he's like, "Oh, that's when you're doing that, you're relaxing your eyes. When your vision is opened right up like that." That's your eyes in a relaxed state. That is to relax your eyes. And I was like, I've been living my life a long time not relaxing my eyes. Not doing that. He's like, yep, that's what relaxed eyes are like. His advice to me was only use the computer for 20 minutes, then go outside for at least a minute and like look at the sky, like an extremely far distance, like infinite distance. Look to the distance and open your eyes. Do that opening eye thing. Open your vision like that. At least for a minute. And then go back and use your computer for 20 more minutes. And this way you'll keep opening up your eyes. It's relaxing. It's to relax your eyes. It's to take a break and relax your eyes. Okay? So that's a pro tip from the optometrist. Okay, question? Well, this looking at the sky thing and like opening my eyes wide, I kind of came up with that myself. No monk ever taught it to me, actually. No monk taught it to me. And I don't really see it in the suttas either. Traditionally, when the monks are walking, let's say to get their alms food, pindapot, alms round, they're supposed to look down about one plow's length ahead, maybe about like 2-3 meters ahead, just looking to the ground in kind of a focused way. And normally they live in a forest where, like the trees are quite tall and the canopy above you pretty much covers the whole sky. You might see a little patch of blue sky straight above you, but that's about it. Yeah, like I've actually met monks where they want to be in the forest like that and there's like no sky to speak of at all. Now, I grew up in Canada in a place that's very wide open. They call it the prairies. So it's extremely flat land, okay? Like if you fly above it in an airplane, it's almost scary because it's as flat as this table. Like you can see hundreds of kilometers and it is absolutely flat like this table. Like you can see all the farmland, all the lines of, you know, each farm side by side, like squares. And it's just flat. It's like a big table as far as you can see in all directions. There's no mountains at all. Like, so when you're just standing on the street, you know, of like my hometown or whatever, when you look straight ahead, you see the sky. The sky comes right down to the street, okay? You look straight ahead, you see the sky. Like, you look in all directions, you just see sky around you. It's almost like if you're not from there, this will, like, kind of creep you out. It's like, yeah. Like, people feel freaked out by this because the sky's, like, just too big. It's not supposed to be that big to them. So I grew up kind of accustomed to that and even liking it. So, I like these wide-open views and stuff. Yeah, like at SBS, there's a couple people here who've been to SBS. When you're driving up the hill to get to the retreat center, there's this building on the left called the Columbarium. And I got a tip for you, which is if you go to the Columbarium, you can see a nice view of Taiping. I don't know if you've ever been there, but there's a nice place to sit, nice place to look. You know, you can see a nice view of Taiping. That was my favorite place to go. Just, you know. And then I would do this thing, yeah, like see out to the sides and, you know, kind of open up my vision. And and it was like joyous. I really liked that. And then do like kind of a space meditation, like feel the space of it.